This production includes discussions about topics such as sexual assault, domestic violence, stalking, emotional violence, and physical violence. This content may be difficult, so should you continue to listen, I encourage you to care for your safety and well-being.
Hey guys, we're back. I am Leslie Jingleski with Avalon Center.
I'm Candace, and I'm from the Avalon Center. And today, we have a very special guest who is also from the Avalon Center. If you want to introduce yourself, Sophia.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me on this episode today. I'm Sophia. I'm with Avalon Youth Services. So Candace and I do a lot of work together with youth in the community and prevention work. So I'm really excited to be here today.
Awesome. Yeah, so this is our third installment in the Unpacking Made series. We're going to talk about episodes 5 and 6, which were intense.
Very intense. Oh, yeah. I feel like we're going to have a lot of content to talk about today. Sophia, we just could been kind of like going through and saying like what's kind of realistic and what's not. And I just felt like these couple episodes were really the turning point for a lot of different things when it came to Alex. And then just how kind of realistic like this situation that she was in was.
Yeah.
So when I started the series, I thought this isn't going to be true. I mean, it's going to be good made for TV, but I have been shocked to date at how realistic and how real the scenarios are. I mean, it started out with a black mold and everything in my body just died.
Oh my gosh. After everything that she had been through to secure that housing for herself and her daughter. And then one thing that upset me is seeing how the black mold, you know, when she took Maddie to the doctor shamed her and made her feel that she was an inadequate mother when she was stuck in this situation with very little means and flexibility, and she didn't even get that empathy, and just contributes to that cycle of stigma for survivors. So that was really heartbreaking.
It's very heartbreaking. I think she said,
she needs you to do better.
Yes,
is what she said.
Those were her exact words.
I wrote that. It shocked me to my core.
Completely unacceptable.
Yeah.
And just how hard she was working, you know, behind the scenes, you know, you're just looking at this situation and like this doctor, of course, who has lots of different privileges and means and all kinds of different connections and probably more of a support system as well. And Alex is there working her butt off, like for every single dollar that she gets, she finally gets this housing, even though, you know, it's not the best, but it was really working out for a second. That's what we had just said in our last episode. We were just like, you know, things are really looking up, and now we're just waiting for things to go downhill again, just because that's just the cycle.
Well, she's surviving, and that's what she's doing. Yeah. She needs to survive.
Absolutely. And I think that points to the need to have more doctors that come from different backgrounds, and we see like how those fields of privilege, a lot of generational wealth, a lot of, you know, rich people have a lot more options, right? People of higher socioeconomic status. So I think that goes to show how the cycle continues and how people that really could support survivors and support these individuals in the situation don't have the awareness and the training and the empathy needed to practice more holistically. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it just definitely didn't sound trauma-informed at all.
That's the word I was going to use, is trauma-informed.
No, not at all.
Not at all. I read a lot about this Barefoot Billy character just because I thought it was just so interesting because she felt some type of like connection with this person.
Yes. But you don't know why.
Yeah.
And I think it unravels, but I think it spoke to two things. I think the first thing was she recognized the abuse that he suffered as a child. So she had empathy for that despite who he had become. She had empathy for his childhood. And as it unravels, I think we're more drawn to understanding her background and kind of unpacking the dreams that she's having. And also, does she, you know, she's hard on herself. As a mother, I am harder on myself than anybody. And I think she's the same way with Maddie and as a mother. So does she compare herself to Barefoot Billy?
Yeah.
In a way. I mean, certainly intentions are not there, but I feel like she definitely, I don't know, she's definitely got some stuff that she needs to unpack. And
she does throughout the episode, which is one of the things, you know, when you're watching a scary movie And that's how I felt. And we were talking about some of the other cringeworthy moments when we're watching this series together. Mm-hmm. And I was just sitting there, and I remember the first time that I was watching it, and I was like, don't go in there. Don't go in there, Alex. Why are you going in there?
She got it. And full on panic attack on screen and off screen, because I was freaking out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The stress of that cubby, and she's trying to remember, and you're trying, you know, you're right along with her. What happened? Because those memories, I mean, we know as adults, your brain goes into protective mode, and it protects you from these things. So crazy.
Yeah. And I think it was a really good representation of what it's like to be an adult and come to terms with even subconscious trauma as a child. And, you know, you can see her uncertainty of, like, why am I relating so much to Billy? Like, I know that he was not treated, and he was not treated well. He was abused by his mother. But, like, why does she feel this, like, very visceral pull towards him, towards his story? And I think, like, the fact that she entered the cupboard, it was like, or the crawl space, everyone was like, no, don't. But it was like her memory of being in the cupboard as a child. And you can kind of just see that recognition. And then the panic attack when she realizes that, like, as the subconscious becomes the conscious. And it just, like, at first you think the dreams with her mother being trapped in the home is like, oh, she's gone missing, like something's wrong. But then as the episode progresses, you realize, no, that's a metaphor for her being abused by her father. And she didn't even know. And she had a completely different, you know, she was gaslit into a completely different memory. So I thought that was really well done and a really beautiful metaphor that progressed throughout the episode.
Yeah, I did too. And, you know, and we had said earlier in some of the earlier episodes, like, there's some people that you're kind of rooting for. And, you know, when you're watching it at first, especially the father, like, wanting to be back in the picture, like, just not knowing all of the facts and just seeing that he, like, wants to be there, you know, you're kind of, as a watcher and listener, like, mm-hmm. hoping, you know, that she utilizes the support, you know, because it's like, she doesn't have anybody. You're thinking in your head, like, why wouldn't she use him? He sounds like he's changed. He has a new family. He has new kids, like, all kinds of things that look stable from the outside, mm-hmm. looking in without any information. And that is another character, you know, that you're almost happy that Alex is so cautious about the people in her life, because, you know, if it would have been a different person or a different situation, I would have trusted the person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's done absolutely. Well. I think it plays to, it pulls at your heartstrings the way that it should and the way that it does in real life. And we've talked about this over and over again. Alex still loves Sean. You can't turn that off just because he violated that love. Mm-hmm. So there's still that love there. Now, is it healthy? No, absolutely not. But it's still there. And I think as people, we kind of shrug our shoulders and push off that emotion, that raw emotion of love. But I think it's important to acknowledge it so that you can move forward from it. And so when we're talking about, you said his name was Nate. Names are not my
favorite.
So the new guy, Nate.
Yeah, the engineer we all love dearly.
Oh, we're going to get into him now.
Well, you know, he's there. And so I guess we might be getting a little far ahead because, well, let's back up. Let's talk about the daycare challenges. This is near and dear to my heart. The daycare challenges are, you know, I remember when my kids were young and we had three kids in daycare, and if they have a runny nose, they're going to call you to come pick them up. And despite, you know, what anybody says, my husband is self-employed. It was my responsibility, you know, and you cannot use, even if you have the support system that I have, you can't use the support system constantly for fear of cashing in all your chips. So it's, I felt this with her on a real level, because there is this struggle of the working mother trying to get the job done and it comes to a point where, am I working to pay for daycare? I mean, is that what I'm doing? And then I'm still having to pay daycare when he's sick, but now I can't work. So he's sick. I have to call out of work. So I'm not getting paid and I'm going and picking him up, but I still have to pay daycare because I need to hold my spot. Mm-hmm. Right. So now, and so that goes back to how isolation starts. I feel like, and whether that's intentional or situational, I don't know. But I can remember when my kids were little and they were constantly, if one of them was sick, and so I felt her on this level just so hard, and the guilt of dropping them off, knowing that they don't feel good, but you have to go, you know, that part, it's sheer desperation, and you feel it with her to your bones, because you want to be a good mother, but in order to be a good mother, you've got to get a job, you've got to work, you've got to provide. Yeah. But in order to do that, you feel like it pulls away at whether or not you are a good mother.
I just feel like it's so overlapping and runs so deep.
Yeah. Really, and going, like, wrapping it back around to domestic violence, she goes to the bar and she was like, I have to work. And he's like, well, I have to bartend. I have to work a double. And she's like, well, I have to work.
Yeah.
And then she comes back in and she's like, can we split it? Can, you know, you do the day or whatever. And he just had absolutely no interest in helping her with this situation. And that, you know, to me, that just really contributed even further. And so in his thing, it was, well, just call your dad. And at that point, we didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, you're like, well, what is the animalistic response that she has against her dad? Because it's been since the beginning. And at this point, we haven't, you know, we don't know for sure that he was abusive. So our mind is coming in, and our gut instincts, those hundreds of years of instincts, are saying, well, she doesn't want the child to go there. There's a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And she went against her instinct. And, you know, our mind is great at talking us out of our instincts, you know, and rationalizing everything. And one of the things that I tell everybody that will listen is, we have hundreds of years of instinct for you to listen to. It's there for a reason, because we are animals. And there's an instinctual ability, the body's ability to help you survive and to keep you away from danger. And I just loved how it is portrayed in this show that, you know, when she does go against her instinct, it always comes back to haunt her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we saw a lot of those pressures that she couldn't work initially in the show. I mean, that's how she was isolated financially as well. And we know financial abuse occurs in 99% of domestic violence cases. Yeah. And so it's very clear to see how that cycle just continues and childcare turns into, they don't, you know, she didn't have any income of her own, and just further disenfranchises her and makes becoming independent that much harder.
So. Yeah, absolutely.
And it seems like I said over and over again, you know, it seems like there's things going good at one point of every single story. I mean, even when, she doesn't listen to her instincts. She does take her father's help, which I was happy, you know, just watching it without knowing stuff. I was like, okay, good. You know, she has another person that's going to help out. They have the room. He said that it's always an open door policy. You know, we're happy for her. She's doing well. He had called her, I think, and he was like, I'll move the stuff out of the house. Like, you can stay as long as you want. So, like, we're getting excited for her. And that's when, you know, she goes back and she really kind of explores that memory that she had,
mm-hmm.
because she had asked her dad, I believe the night before, about the cupboard, and he blatantly lied to her.
Yep.
And
gaslit her.
Honestly,
yes.
Yeah. Honestly, I knew he was lying.
Yeah. There was something about it.
Yeah.
And it was kind of cool that the show did that too, because as we're watching it, you know, there was you knew he was lying. You knew it.
We're feeling that unease with her, that suspicion, that like that feeling like, something's not right here, but I don't know what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when you had mentioned earlier, like, especially why people behave in the ways that they behave, you're like, and sometimes, you know, abusers do some of the power and control tactics out of desperation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, it was almost like desperation in his voice that, like, he did not want her to know. Like, he was going to do whatever it took and lie however he wanted so that she did not remember that memory. Like, yeah. And I thought that was interesting.
And too. I just think that was, kind of almost the nail in the coffin that all of this supposed improvement, you know, the wife, the house, the kids, like, he's a born again Christian. He has these values and he wants to be there for Alex. I think that second you know that he's not telling the truth is when you have to come to that really sad realization that none of these, like, it's not Alex that's not accepting the help. It's like he actually has not changed and society thinks he has because he's checked up all these boxes, but in reality he's not willing to take
accountability. That's how it is. They're charismatic.
Yeah.
They're charismatic and people love them. And that's why you said it. That's why their tactics are effective. And then, so then the housing crisis, right? So she is trying to find a place. So Nate comes in and says, with daycare. Well, no, let's back up. So why did she leave the daycare?
They
gave her the wrong kid.
Also, yeah. I think she couldn't go back because she was sick for a certain amount of days too.
Well, there was that, but then she went back. And when she went back, I guess girl that was working there quit. And there was a guy there and she came and she pushed the button. And the guy brought her the wrong child.
And after like 45 minutes of waiting.
That's not my child.
So rude. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, you know, so obviously at that point, we're not going back to that daycare. So she's struggling. She needs an adequate daycare. And when you're on government assistance, a lot of the more reliable daycares don't accept them because they don't have to.
Right.
From a business model standpoint, and this is valid. We need to acknowledge this. From a business model standpoint, if you don't have to accept government assistance and you have a wait list, why would you? Right? So you have to think about that from the business owner as well. And you have to think about, you know, for her, it's not okay. We're going to pull my child out. I got to figure it out. I'm going to figure it out in a minute, but I know we're not coming back here. Then Nate comes to the rescue. I'm going to talk to my daycare provider and see. And then, you know, the government vouchers and they came through with everything. But she did have to live in Fisher Island?
Fisher Island. Yeah.
Yeah. Fisher Island.
She had to live in Fisher Island. So now she needs to go find a place to live in Fisher Island. And from what I'm gathering, Fisher Island is
like Williamsburg.
Yeah. Like,
to me, like, very, like, yeah. Like, if a person was in this situation, I feel like in Williamsburg, Virginia, like, there would be far and in between of.
It's a real, I just sat on a board meeting, a council meeting last week about the housing issue in Williamsburg. And it's not just Williamsburg. It's so many different places. And the inventory is just not there.
Yeah.
So then you go. So then you go and you follow her, and she's going through this process where she has all these government vouchers, which is not welfare, right? And she has to explain that to people. But the landlords don't want to deal with the amount of red tape they have to jump through to get it. And with the inventory so low, they don't have to, right? Because if you don't want it, I've got somebody else that does.
Mm-hmm.
So she's in a hard spot. And then here comes this woman with this beautiful waterfront apartment who has, for some reason, Alex pulled at her heartstrings.
Yeah. One thing I will say about that entire process is something that I admired about her is, like, you know, the more that the show goes on, just the more resilient and like, you just get to see how intelligent, like, Alex really is. Mm-hmm. Like, and just, you know, some of that trauma kind of coming out in the way that she speaks and then she acts, like, because she, you know, she's been through so many different experiences, and how she utilized that to be resilient and to be smart and to talk to different people in a different way. And it was just, it was kind of empowering to watch her at the same time as it was, you know, frustrating for us to watch, because we're like, this is, this situation feels impossible. I can't imagine being in it, but look at how she's doing it. Like she hasn't stopped. She keeps going to new places. She keeps talking. The way that she finessed some of the conversations,
I love it.
It was just, it was kind of really cool to experience and just to really keep rooting for her in this process as she's going through it.
But resilience is, in my opinion, can be a person's most valuable trait. Resilience is anybody who's successful, anybody who has made something of their life, made some kind of impact, no matter what that impact is, they've measured themselves as successful, and everybody's success is different. And you measure your own success, right? Anybody who has deemed themselves as successful has, I guarantee you, has resilience. Because if you don't, then you get knocked down at the first level.
Yeah.
So I love resilience. I just love it. And I love her. Everybody's fallen in love with Alex.
Yeah.
I just love her.
But you know, we do get frustrated with her at some points. I don't know how you feel, Sophia, like just about like, just how we're pulling on our heartstrings, but then sometimes you're watching it and you're like, why are you doing that?
The party?
Yeah.
I know you're going to be pissed off, Candace.
When we talk about the party stressed me out. And I think there's something, like, resilience is such a crucial trait, and we know this, and we know that it's an incredibly important life skill, but there's something almost heartbreaking about how much Alex is asked to be resilient, that that's not something that she should have to go through, where time and time again, the only thing that's propping her up is this endless labor. And it's, you know, not only just the job, but it's, you know, time is this luxury that she does not have. And so resilience is all she has, because systems keep failing her and her support systems aren't what they need to be. So there's something very tragic about needing to lean on resiliency that much, because you're seeing that the system is failing her, and that's, she only has herself at the end of the day, and the care of Maddie. So yeah, the party stressed me out because it felt that, you know, she was under a lot of pressure, and
I almost feel like the landlord pressured her. She knew it was a bad idea.
She knew, she did. And that was the other thing when we keep talking about intuition, because, you know, with her trauma, with her experience, with how resilient you could see that she is, like, she has the gut feeling that she has about every little thing at first, like, is valid, I think, at a lot of times when you're watching it. She was saying, like, no, I don't want to have the party. And in our minds, we're like, yeah, that's a good idea. Like, you have it really set up there. And you're almost, like, rooting.
Public park, right.
Yeah, like, we're like, finally, we got to this good place. Let's not go down that roller coaster again. We're rooting for you, Alex. We want you to be in this really, really nice spot with a good daycare. And
no mold.
And no mold. And then I think this is the point where I was starting, and this is from our own experiences, right? And how I was saying in different characters, you know, you kind of root for. This is when I was like, Nate is his name, right? This was the point of the show that I was like, oh, wow, like, this, he's a good person. Like, maybe this is a good partner for her. Maybe this is a person that, you know, you could really settle down with and build a life with, and then you wouldn't have to work as hard. Like, as you're watching it, you're like, wow, he shows a lot of interest. You know,
he's... Oh, I'm totally Team Nate right now, but I haven't seen the whole series.
Yeah, so this was the point of the series that I was like, he's a really good person. And then just watching, and this might have been from my own experiences too, you know, when we're watching TV or when we're doing anything, really, you have your own perception of things. And I was just thinking about all the times that my friends had, like, left a really bad toxic relationship, and then when the good person, you know, came around and that was interested in them, you know, how all your friends, you kind of just root for the good person without knowing all of the information yet. And I think that's where I was in the show, where I was like, oh my gosh, this person is way better for you. Like, I really hope that she takes a leap of faith and just gives
them a shot. Well, because if this was romantic comedy, that would be the end all.
Yeah.
Right. So, and knowing that this is not a romantic comedy, I have suspicions, but I don't know that I would have those suspicions if I didn't, number one, do the work that I do.
Right.
And number two, know that things are, it's too early in the season for things to get better.
Right.
So that's where I am. Otherwise, I think I'd be 100% team Nate.
Even at the party, he was literally the hero. Like,
yep,
he was.
But also, I was mad at him for not helping her set boundaries. Like, he truly was like, we're going to paint some faces over here. And there are like people showing up and like clearly Alex is uncomfortable. And I feel like he didn't really step in like a helping her set a boundary way. He kind of just was on the peripheral. And I feel like she really needed that backup. And he was the only person that could have given it.
Yeah, yeah. I agreed. But also at the same time, I felt that, you know, she kind of set a clear boundary earlier about the car.
Exactly.
So he kind of probably feels like I'm trying to get on her good side. So I'm going to do whatever I can. But that's also, you know, love bombing as well that we, you know, experience a lot when it comes to, we're talking about toxic relationships. You know, these people are the people that do whatever they can just to get your attention. But at the end of the day, it's not long lasting. They don't have intention of keeping that behavior long term. Mm-hmm. It's only to get whatever that they want from the person. So that's, like you said, just from my professional standpoint, when I was watching it, I was rooting for him. But at the same time, I was concerned just because of the work that we do. And yes, Sophia, I agree. I wanted him to be if you want to be her partner, be a partner in that. She needed your help.
And with caution, though.
As a friend, like if my friend was in that situation, I feel like I'd be like, no, y'all got to go. Like she'd been trying to say that. And no one was listening to her. And that's because she has no backup. And, you know, Sean, it was all people Sean knew. And Sean had instilled this message that Alex was weak or whatever, and that she couldn't stand up for herself and that she was easy to walk all over. And so that's what they tried to do. And ultimately Alex was kind of left holding the bag, and, you know, then we can get into what happened to her housing. Right. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
Everything that is bad in Alex's life is traced back to domestic violence. And so, and everything bad in Sean's life can be traced back to his childhood. And, you know, he does end up going back to substance abuse and ends up naked on our landlord's couch. And I'm going to be real honest with you. As much empathy as I have for the situation, as a landlord, I can understand that puts them in danger.
Yeah.
You know, you have to look at it from all aspects and put the blame where the blame is. And the blame is on the abuser. Because I think at first I was like, why did you kick her out? She was obviously sorry. But then I got to thinking about it and I was like, now we are making... The blame needs to be put where the blame deserves to be. And, you know, I'm on the fence from the landlord's perspective because I kind of see their side. You've got to look at their peaceful environment. And then she has a party and somebody ends up breaking into their house and sleeping on their couch. Obviously, Sean had no intentions of hurting them. But how did they know that?
Yeah.
They don't.
I think that there's, I don't know. Yeah. I'm kind of, I understand their own individual safety concerns, but I think like the blame is on Sean. And I'm wondering if there would have been other remedies, whether that's like a restraining order for the home, right? So he can't come in within 500 feet of the house. Or, you know, she knew a bit of Alex's story when she had come in to see the place and they had kind of had a conversation. And I think a general level of knowledge is that she was in a bad place, that there was something going on. And I think there was an issue of them continually pressuring her to host something at their house, given that situation. I think they saw Alex trying to control things. So I think the unfortunate reality is like, I feel like they should have pursued other remedies or really had a conversation before making the decision to kick Alex out, because it felt like they were perpetuating that cycle of like almost victim blaming unintentionally.
Yes.
You know, and like, it's just another obstacle a survivor has to face. And it's like, if we had tried and thought a little critically about how we could have pursued other methods of remedy, you know, Alex would still have a home and they know she's in this tough spot and that housing isn't easy to come by. So I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think that's tough too. But also, just like we're in working in domestic violence, as we point out over and over again, you know, the emotional abuse and all the abuse that Alex went through when it came to Sean. But just how we keep saying over and over again, you know, when it comes to domestic violence and substance abuse, you know, there is that fear there, because at any moment it can be extreme
and escalated.
So and escalate, that's the word I was looking for. Yeah. It can escalate at any point. So I think from their standpoint too, I think fear does a lot of things to people. And I just think that these landlords were just scared.
Well, we have the benefit of knowing what we know.
Yeah.
And they don't. And so I think while their intentions were to help her, they maybe got a little bit more. We know that domestic violence, you're going to have escalation and you're going to have all of these things. But I think that's where we strive to do better about education.
Mm-hmm.
So we can educate people on, you know, what all is involved. And, I don't know. My heart was torn there. I don't like that she is really forced to move in with Nate.
Yeah.
Yeah. That reliance on a man consistently. And that, you know, I think it's conflict because you feel like this pull of like, oh, I really hope that the good guy wins.
Right.
And, you know, she'll have some support. And that's very common that like in, especially in a patriarchal society, that women in order when they survivors, they have to continue that cycle of reliance on a man because of financial abuse and, you know, no financial independence. And
yeah.
So you're kind of conflicted. You're like, I want her to be happy, but I don't want her to have to rely on him.
I like what you just said, Sophia, about like the patriarchal society and how it just continues to push survivors and, you know, even of any types of relationships into that going with the good person and like kind of like pushing you into that situation. And yeah, I was rooting for him at that point, but just knowing what we do, like we had just mentioned over and over again, you know, there was that fear part of her moving in with him.
But she's the only stable thing that she has right now, for all appearances.
Mm-hmm.
He is the only stable thing in her life right now. And I don't, you know, like I said, he appears to be stable. My gut's telling me something different. But where else is she going to go?
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. She's surviving. She is absolutely surviving. And you do what you have to do when you survive. You go through making decisions out of desperation. And again, 100%, this is why it takes survivors on average 7 times to leave their abuser. Because at this point, it would have been easier for her to go back to Sean.
Yeah. She had nowhere to go.
Yeah. She's got irresponsibility all around her. She's surrounded by it. Her mother.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Her
piece.
You know, and her mother clearly has mental health issues. She's manic. You know, it has to be tugging on her. I don't want to be my mom.
Yeah.
So she's in a tough spot. I am getting, I'm really attached to this series. I am very excited to see what happens in episode 7, because I feel like we're getting close to the culmination of everything.
Yeah. And you are correct on that.
Am I?
Yeah.
I figured.
The only other big thing, before we get off today, and we skipped it over earlier, but one of the pivotal moments in episode 5 was when she saw the other survivor on the street with her abuser.
Danielle.
Yes.
I forgot all about her.
Yeah. So I wrote down a couple of things. I just kind of wanted to get you guys' point of view on it, because, you know, we're talking about domestic violence and, you know, we work in this. So a lot of times this is the real situation that a lot of survivors experience, seeing other survivors who had helped them, who had coached them, who had been there for them, go back to their abusers and seeing them on the street, because, you know, this is a community of people and you are going to run into people and, or you're going to see a picture of them on Facebook or something like that. Like, there is going to be a reminder that somebody made a different decision. And I just, Alex being panicked at the door, screaming at, the director of the shelter, right? Just saying, like, yeah, how can someone stay with someone who's abusing them? You know, she's just so passionate about it, you know, because she had also, you know, she has that personal input in it as well, because, you know, she's like, well, I'm doing it, you know,
she this has hard perspective, yeah, of a survivor.
Yeah. Like,
absolutely.
I'm doing it. Like, this is hard. And, I just loved the things that she was saying to her. So I'm just going to say those real quick. Yeah. She said, maybe she's lying to herself to survive, which I thought was like pretty impactful. The other thing she said is, you don't know what she's running from.
You don't.
And then she said, the cycle of abuse comes from generations, which is something that, Leslie, you say over and over again when we're going through this podcast.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was such a pivotal moment for, you know, just talking about domestic violence and just seeing how it unfolded, because, you know, that was a very realistic situation that a lot of survivors experience.
And I do want to say something about empathy, because we talk about empathy a lot. And I was reading, and I honestly cannot tell you where I read it. It was recent. It was talking about empathy and people who have considered an empath, where you can feel the room. And it was an interesting perspective. And I feel like Alex exhibits these. The perspective was, you consider yourself an empath because your entire life, it's a protection mechanism. It is a fear mechanism. Because even as a child, you walked into the room, you are biologically programmed to read the room so that you know what kind of mood everybody is in order to protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that really struck with me, because you identify emotions and you have developed this as a coping mechanism to survive. So I feel like Alex exhibits all of these traits, because she goes into the room and she analyzes everything. She knows how everybody's feeling, what they're doing. And it's not a personality trait. It is something that is learned over time. You learn, if you have an abusive mom, if you have an abusive dad, you learn to walk into the room and identify the mood that they're in order to protect yourself. So I don't know why this struck me so much with her, but I feel like that is absolutely her. She reads the room. She's concerned about how other people feel. She doesn't want to make people angry. And that is absolutely a safety mechanism for her.
That generational trauma,
mm-hmm,
I think, really manifests not only in, yeah, it is a very natural trauma response to be hyper aware of others and their situations. And I think that speaks to her instincts, her gut feeling. And it's kind of a double-edged sword, because this is a product of trauma, but at the same time, like, this is the shield that she's created for herself. And at a certain point, she has to listen to it. Like, that gut instinct is the product of that trauma. And I think you see generational trauma even when, you know, the cycle of abuse, and it makes individuals who experience it in childhood more susceptible to it in their adult life. And even if it's subconscious, right? Like, Alex didn't fully know that her father had been physically abusive to her mother. And yet it still was there somewhere. And it still manifests in the vulnerabilities and the trauma response. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting, and it's difficult to address, because a lot of people don't have the mechanisms to address those mental health concerns and to get the help they need to unlearn a lot of that.
That was good.
Well, to be continued, guys. We're going to come back and next week we're going to unpack episodes 7 and 8.
Yeah.
And then we'll do our final unpacking. And we have Juanita Graham, who's going to come on with us.
We're
to
so
do.
Excited.
I know. She's going to do. She's a counselor, and she is going to help us unpack the entire series and wrap it up. Here we are. We're more than halfway through, I think, you know, thus far, minus a couple of things here and there. This is a pretty accurate rendition and a pretty accurate portrayal of what survivors go through. So we'll see what happens. And you guys can please click like, please follow our podcast, please download the podcast. We appreciate it. Also, if you guys have questions that you'd like us to address in the next podcast, definitely throw them in the comments, and let us know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sophia. Yes, we're really excited to have you. And just being like kind of in the age group, and then also Sophia is in law school, so that kind of put us in a little nice input that had that unique perspective. Yes, exactly. So we were excited to have you on thank this you episode so much. And just continue to work together as we always do.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This is a really great conversation. It's so nice to, you know, bounce thoughts and reactions off each other. So I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Awesome. Bye, guys. We'll see you next week. Take care.
Avalon Center's podcast, Responding with Hope, is paid for by the Department of Social Services. Avalon Center offers emergency shelter, individual and group counseling, and much more to survivors of domestic and sexual assault. If you need help, call our 24-hour hotline at 833-537-0970 or visit us at avaloncenter.org.